Ah, ye see, in our ship's moving parts, there be a thing called the biceps. It's a tough old rope that helps us hoist the sails and lift heavy loot. But alas, this biceps rope be getting swollen and making our matey wince in pain.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Ignite 2023 Conference Conversations Podcasts, Series 4, brought to you by the Physiotherapy Research Foundation, supporting the promotion and translation of research. Let's get started.
Hello, and welcome to the Physiotherapy Research Foundation podcast. I am your host for today, Dr. Daniel Harvey. It's my honor to host as a past Physiotherapy Research Foundation grant recipient. I am currently the director of the Master of Advanced Clinical Physiotherapy program at the University of South Australia. I'm also a pain scientist, and my work has frequently intersected with the digital world of innovation and technology, and on occasion of artificial intelligence. This will be our topic for today and how these things intersect with the world of physiotherapy. Before I introduce my guests for today, we'd like to acknowledge the Turrbal and Yuggera peoples of Meanjin as the original owners and custodians of the lands on which we meet, work, and learn. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In the studio today, I have Professor Stephen McPhail and Dr. Ryan Gallagher. Rather than try and introduce themselves myself, I'll hand over perhaps to you first, Stephen, and just give yourself a brief introduction.
Hi, I'm Steve. Is that too brief?
No. Much too brief, yeah.
I'm Steve McPhail, Centre Director for the Australian Centre for Health Services Innovation, or OSHI, in the Centre for Healthcare Transformation at the Queensland University of Technology. I also lead digital health informatics research at Metro South Hospital and Health Service, which is, we've been on, you know, quite a long journey where we went from being fully analog to fully digital. And in the last, we're the first large scale health service to be fully digital and paperless. So it's been an exciting journey. We've been on that journey for, you know, 8 or 9 years now, and we're seeing the fruit of that. And along that way, I became very interested in digital health and informatics, and now increasingly artificial intelligence as we look to really translate some of this innovation into real-world practice.
Amazing. Thanks. Over to you, Ryan.
G'day. I'm Ryan Gallagher. I'm a physiotherapist first and foremost, and have been for over 15 years now. But I am now a data science, and I'm a data science manager at Honeysuckle Health, a digital healthcare and data science company. And I am also a conjoint senior lecturer at the University of Newcastle. After nearly 14 years of clinical practice in the public health system, I learned the power of data and how much that's going to transform healthcare and the profession. Took the opportunity to retrain in data science and pick up some skills in that space, and have really been fortunate to find a space where I can apply my clinical knowledge and apply the learnings in AI and in machine learning into a clinical environment to get some really, really exciting outcomes.
Cool. Actually, I'd like to start there if I can. Ryan, what was it that made you as a clinical physio move into the world of tech and innovation?
Yeah, good question. I guess the first thing was doing, I did my PhD first, and I did fall in love with the whole data aspect of nearly 3 years worth of data collection, and then having that aha moment as you sat there and turned that into an insight and had the realization that, hang on, I'm no longer talking about helping a patient. I'm talking about helping an entire population of patients. And that, I found that really powerful and fell in love with that, and basically made a decision after doing my PhD that I wanted to continue to do that. I was going to go down the stats path because data science and stats are, you know, physio to OT basically, in terms of professions. But I also realized that learning to code and having some skills in that space is probably going to be something really valuable moving forward. And that's when I discovered that's what data scientists do, stats and coding. So that was the path that I went down, and don't regret it at all.
Cool. I know we were talking yesterday, I mentioned the idea of skill stacking, where you take skills that often exist in one profession and you stack on skills from another. I think they can be real amplifiers in terms of their impact that you can have. Perhaps before we go a bit further, recognizing that much of our audience might not be technophiles like we are, could I throw to you, Stephen, and maybe you could give us a bit of background and even a definition of what is artificial intelligence? What do we mean when we talk about innovation?
It's actually not that easy to answer on one hand, because many of the things that we call artificial intelligence, if you speak to some statisticians, they'll say that's just statistics. And of course, we're actually drawing on the same, you know, foundational base of mathematics and computer science as well. And applying these things together where we have advanced analytics capacity, which was sort of previously being held back by computational power. Now we're in this new era where we can do amazing things with data. And so some of the ideas that may have been good in theory, we can now do in practice with our analytics. And so if you imagine we had, you know, very good statistics and then we supercharged it with, you know, computational power and the lessons we've learned from computer science and put them together, we end up in this place of having artificial intelligence. It's not magic dust. Mm-hmm. What we do often get the feeling that, you know, if we just sprinkle the artificial intelligence magic dust on things, it will somehow fix everything. It's not like that at all. Mm-hmm. We do need to be mindful in how we go about addressing our problems using artificial intelligence. But we do definitely have new opportunities that we didn't have before, and we're seeing new outcomes that we couldn't have achieved before without AI.
Yeah, I think one thing that came across to me from your talk yesterday is that, to some extent, the label of artificial intelligence is a rebranding. And not to say it's not unique and more powerful than what we had before, but what we previously might have thought of as statistics or a calculation or an algorithm, or maybe the next thing was machine learning. Is it really just the complexity of the mathematics and the modeling behind it, combined with the extra computational power afforded to us by modern microchips? Is that what gets us from what we had before to now something we could call artificial intelligence?
Oh, yes, they're definitely key features. I think also we do often think of machine learning and artificial intelligence as the same thing. And artificial intelligence includes a number of other elements. But machine learning is probably the one that we're seeing the most around when it comes to, particularly when it comes to applied clinical practice at this stage, yeah.
Yeah, it's probably a nice segue. Maybe now we could move forwards and you could both share a little bit about how your work has intersected with technological innovation more broadly, perhaps, but in particular, artificial intelligence. So perhaps I'll throw to you first there, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so echoing with what sort of Steve just sort of said there, that there is a bit of a misnomer in terms of some of the terminology, and there is a bit of hype and a bit of lay people labeling things as artificial intelligence when it's garden variety stats, particularly like here in a scientific conference space. Like, you've been hearing about machine learning for decades, you just haven't heard it called that before. It's, you know, what most people call linear and logistic regression. What's been the really big buzz over the last 10 years has been the ability to move beyond, you know, small data sets and move beyond Excel files and move to entire databases and to move to images and to move to using data in a format that hasn't been available to us before. So that's probably where a lot of the hype and a lot of excitement comes from.
Do you think that part of that is also we're seeing it move from purely being in the research context now to being in the implementation?
Oh, 100%. 100%. And the pace in which it's coming along, particularly over the last decade and now again in the last 18 months in terms of what's popped up. It's hit mainstream. People can see it firsthand and what it's doing, and they're looking for opportunities to apply it into everyday use and naturally into clinical care. And if it's not the physios coming in with ideas for how to use it, it's patients coming in and asking questions off things like ChatGPT or Bing, as it's now integrated into. They're coming and asking questions off it. So we do need to be aware of what it is and understand and how to use it.
And what are some of those areas, perhaps particularly, that you've been involved with?
The key things that I've sort of been looking at, I've got a program of work looking to use some longitudinal data to basically in stroke outcomes. I've been looking at using MRIs of people's brains in the first 48, 72 hours after having a stroke and linking that with routinely collected rehabilitation data to build out an ability to identify, can we predict what someone's outcome is going to look like after a stroke? We're still in the early stages of going through that work. But we are starting to see some promising results to be able to sort of predict, and it's probably a too strong a word, estimate with more accuracy than what we probably can, currently to understand that this is what it's going to look like for you as a stroke survivor or as a family member when you do leave hospital. Mm. So the ability to do that at scale with data that we wouldn't traditionally have used or looked at as physios before is quite interesting and exciting. So I guess it's that combination of the data that's now available to us in terms of radiology data, routinely collected rehabilitation data, the ability to join those together, link them, but then also having the computational ability to analyze that data, particularly the radiology data that we wouldn't have previously had even access to 5-6 years ago, is super exciting.
I can see real uses for that in, you know, understanding prognosis, even discharge planning for the future, identifying responders, potential responders to rehabilitation care. I can also see some real ethical issues there as well, because if you're trying to predict my mum's outcome after a stroke and then try to suggest her care should go one way or the other on the basis of that, I know that I would feel quite uncomfortable about that.
Yeah, you raise some good valid points. And I guess the key thing that's always going to come out of this is those ethical discussions and what this looks like in a clinical care context. I don't think you're ever going to have a situation where an algorithm is going to decide care for someone. I absolutely think you're going to have a situation where an algorithm is going to be no different to a MRI scan or to a blood test to a clinician in terms of it's a new layer of information to guide them that they wouldn't have necessarily had. But just like a blood test doesn't diagnose you or an X-ray doesn't diagnose you, a health professional does, looking at that information. And I think that this will settle and these ethical conversations will settle along that same line, that you'll never have a situation when the algorithm says this, therefore that's what's going to happen. But you will have that a new layer of information that is a new form of clinical test available to you to help guide your decision-making.
Yeah, and I think something physiotherapy does really well, I think, is have clinical reasoning at the core, not one particular test or one particular model of practice. So seeing it as just one more piece of information into our clinical reasoning process seems to perhaps help overcome some of the potential ethical dilemmas that might come from it. In a moment, maybe I'll share a little bit of how my work has also intersected with innovation and AI. First, perhaps I'll throw to you again, Steve, and you can share with us how your work has intersected with that space.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so really, the sort of work that we do, we want to bring innovation to life in health services, in practice, and make sure that that integration from research lab work progresses to clinical practice where we can impact the real world. And to do that in ways that are sustainable and also well integrated with existing workflows and practices. Now, in the space of AI, that creates a whole lot of new, I think of them as opportunities, but it's also problems as well. And so it has been an interesting time to be alive when we have, I would estimate, thousands or maybe even tens of thousands of predictive models developed from AI algorithms, of which very few, surprisingly few, have ever demonstrated an effect of benefit in a real-world clinical setting. And we don't hear this with the hubris of Silicon Valley, you know, coming out. And when we see these amazing things with generative AI, you know, that's all so exciting. But we can't forget that actually we need to check that we can convert what is a prediction into a meaningful change in practice that actually improves outcomes beyond what we were doing anyway. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the big gap is, I think, at the moment. And so it is an exciting time to be doing work in the implementation space, as we look to move beyond algorithms and move beyond prediction. And even as Ryan was saying before, you know, we need to be able to ensure that when we link these data sets together and combine clinical information with a new layer of informatics, that presented to clinicians in the right way so that it can augment their decision-making in a positive way, not just be another part of a noise interference in an otherwise busy lot of information that gets shoved at them anyway. And so that's where I think we're really making some good advances in how to do that. But it's a long road. And I think the advance of the lab work is progressing very rapidly. And the advance in clinical practice day to day is still lagging behind, as it should to some extent, but perhaps lagging behind a bit more than perhaps we would all like. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And some of them are very good reasons. So we need to ensure we've got you know, appropriate governance and accountability, clinical accountability. We've got to make sure things are regulated properly. And these might sound like really boring things, but they're actually super important, because if we get that wrong, we lose trust. And once we lose trust and social license to start to use advanced analytics and informatics to inform and augment our practice, then we're going to be fighting a very uphill battle to ever win that trust back. So we've got to get it right from the outset. So how about you, Dan? Tell us about your experiences.
Yeah, well, actually quite different to you guys. Artificial intelligence, machine learning has intersected with my pain research in a couple of ways. I'm involved in a project led by Professor Tasha Stanton, where we're developing something analogous to mirror therapy for phantom limb pain, but in virtual reality. One of our approaches there is using muscle activity detected at the stump of the amputated limb, and we detect that muscle activity using EMG, electromyography, and we use machine learning to train the software to understand what movement was intended by the person with phantom limb pain, such that we can translate that into movement of a digital limb. So if I back up, theoretical patient is wearing a virtual reality headset, and they look down at where their missing limb was, but in place of that we have let's call it a digital prosthetic, and we can make that look like it's a real limb, or we can actually make it look like a prosthetic. And then we can play games with them where they kick a soccer ball with their digital limb. But it's going to be different for everyone as to what particular pattern of muscle activity is going to relate to their intention to kick the ball versus bring their leg back again. So I guess that's an example of where we're using this technology to create new therapies. And a similar example of that relates to another thing that I'm working on, which is virtual walking for people with spinal cord injury related pain. And people might not know, but something like 2/3 of people have quite debilitating ongoing neuropathic pain after a spinal cord injury. And unlike something like mirror therapy, where you can put your intact and moving limb on one side of a mirror and create an illusion that the affected side of your body on the other side is still moving, you can't do that if both sides of your body are paralyzed and affected. But we can bring back the appearance that the body is moving in virtual reality, and we can do that in the first person. And our approach to that so far has been to work with paraplegics who will move their arms, and in sync to their arm movement, we have their legs moving. So they simply need to swing their arms while they're sitting in their wheelchair, and they'll find themselves walking through a forest again with real digital legs that are moving. But what's turned out to be quite difficult is to make that feel natural. Intuitively, we thought, oh yeah, we'll just synchronize the right arm moving forwards with the left leg moving forwards. But if you sort of lock those together, you end up with something like a robot. And so we're now working with Zena Trost and Sylvie Augustin, who've created some software where they use machine learning to train a more natural gait. So it uses the sensor data from the headset and the hand controllers in order to learn how best to synchronize leg and arm movements so that it feels natural. I'll share one more example. Another broad thing I've been interested in the pain space is pain education and how changing beliefs can really impact people's psychological well-being, pain itself, and disability. But you know, one of the things we come up against in that space is the power of imaging findings. It can be very hard to convince someone it's safe to get back moving again if they have a very scary sounding imaging report. And I became interested in using, actually quite a while ago, I became interested in how we could rewrite imaging reports to make them honest but less threatening to people. And my non-health professional cousin seems to have come up with a good idea. She had an ultrasound report recently on her shoulder, and it described all kinds of scary sounding things. And she was really quite anxious about it until her partner cut and pasted the imaging report into ChatGPT with the prompt, rewrite this and explain this in the voice of a pirate. To give you some idea of the power of that, let me just read you a couple of sentences of what came out of that.
Dan, you've got to do this in a pirate voice, I believe, is the convention.
If I have to. R-E-C, in our ship's moving parts, there be a thing called the biceps. It's a tough old rope that helps us hoist the sails and lift heavy loot. But alas, this biceps rope be getting swollen and making our mighty wince in pain. The salty dogs call it biceps tenosynovitis. And the result of that was actually her being able to detach herself, at least, from that. And it seemed to have a real positive impact. You know, if it was my patient, I would have liked to have read it and screened it first, perhaps. But even without that, it seemed to have quite a profound impact. So as we get towards the end of our time, perhaps it could be worth delving in a little bit more of what you see are some of the potential downsides and risks, maybe where you see that we might be overhyping this space, and if you feel to touch on it as well, where you think the future might be going from here. You happy to take that one first, Ryan?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there is a lot of hype in this space at the moment, and there's a lack of knowledge of what it's actually going to look like. This is the modern day gold rush, and not getting caught up in that is going to be the key to it. I think that the biggest risk is probably around inappropriate use and not understanding the limitations that comes with using AI. AI is only as good as the data it's provided, and that is the most critical success factor for any predictive algorithm, for any machine learning system, is the quality of the data. And if you are introducing biases into your data, then you are going to introduce biases into your algorithms as well. And it's critical that we understand that as health professionals, the implications that can come from that. Not representing minorities correctly in our data, bringing in clinical assumptions into the data, which may not necessarily hold true, will have consequences for the accuracy of anything that we use. And then there's the issues still to be talked through and worked around in terms of data safety and data quality and what that looks like. Mm. And these aren't things that we're necessarily trained to understand as physios. We understand patient confidentiality and the need to maintain that, but what that looks like in a modern day world where you need, with the clinical information we collect is going to power the decision-making tools we use in the future. We do have some work to do as a profession to build our understanding of what that looks like, and probably recognizing that, you know, our scope of practice is going to need to change in that space. And we're also going to have to expand our multidisciplinary teams to potentially talk about bringing in technologists and bringing in a new profession, a new scope to help with this that may not currently exist.
Yeah, absolutely. I think because we're such a physically based profession, I think it's not necessarily an inherent skill set within our profession at this point.
Yeah. And I generally think it's going to need to be in the future because if we don't, someone else will. And that's the short of it. Patients are going to be coming to us more and more, wanting to use technology, wanting to understand how they can integrate it. And if we don't understand that as a profession and look to integrate that into our care pathways and into our training, we will get caught by other professions that do. But yeah, moving forward, what that looks like in terms of the traditional model of care and in terms of we're a very hands-on profession, we're a very manual profession, integrating that with some of the work like what you're doing in terms of how do we take that from a physical environment to a virtual environment and using technology and using AI to help with that. Something that, yeah, as a profession, we probably need to start having more conversations at a bit more pace than what we are, given how quickly this technology is progressing.
Yeah. Thanks, Ryan. I'm sure a lot of that resonated with you, Stave.
Yeah, absolutely. I think aside from the things Ryan just mentioned, which I won't go into further depth, but we can't overstate the importance of getting the foundations right in terms of the data and many of the assumptions that we make about the quality of data that are entering systems. They need to be verified because often they're false assumptions. But I won't go into the technical side right now. I think perhaps another consideration, particularly in the context of physiotherapy practice, is really about who is going to do it and how in terms of getting it into practice. So if we're looking at products that are consumer products, some of these things are going to require TGA approval. We need to make sure we're aware of that. We can be buying products from overseas that don't even have TGA approval, and then that has flow implications for us. So we need to be aware of when and when we do and when we don't need that. If we're trying to do things ourselves, we end up in a similar sort of considerations regarding the regulation for safety. And it sounds so boring saying all this stuff, and the innovator in me wants to whack myself over the head. But it is actually really important that we get that bit right. And then as part of that, how's it going to be funded, right? Because this is, it's like virtual care to some extent. Virtual care, there's some technology barriers to providing care in a virtual context. But when it comes to maintaining algorithms, when it comes to integrating AI with our other systems from which we want to input data, particularly, say, in a hospital setting or in a large organization beyond an individual private practice, there may be some supports for that. If we're doing it in a private practice setting, there's going to be a limited technology budget. And even in large health services, there's a limited technology budget. And so when the decisions need to be made about, do we bring in this new technology, which is going to have a flow-on effect to 20 other systems in terms of connection and cyber implications, privacy, this is a real consideration. All that costs money to fund. And so as we look at our existing funding structures, I should also mention I'm a health economist. Maybe I shouldn't mention that. I'll be very unpopular. But the idea of having new technologies come in and us committing time and resources to that, we need to actually demonstrate that it's worthwhile. Is it really worthwhile for our patients? Is it worthwhile for the society in general? And I think that's where we need to commit some time and effort as researchers, is to demonstrating that value. Because when we can demonstrate that the value is there for the patients and for society, then the mechanism for funding just becomes almost a financial engineering problem, which is much easier to solve than understanding or generating information to understand whether it really does have the benefits that we hope for the cost that it's going to take us. And cost is, there's cost in cash cost, but there's also cost in our time and cost in patients' time. And we need to understand that well so that we make good decisions and provide high value care.
I think that is a perfect note to finish on. So thank you both, Ryan and Steve, for a really interesting discussion.
Thanks,
Dan. Thank you.
You've been listening to another episode of Conference Conversations, brought to you by the Physiotherapy Research Foundation. Make sure you catch the next episode in the Conference Conversations podcast series. Thanks for listening.